Welcome to the Well Studying Podcast. This is episode 18. I'm your host, John Pugliano. I'm the founder and money manager at investablewealth.com. We have an information-packed episode coming up for you today. Everything is focused on listener feedback and listener questions. But before we get into our main topics, let me first thank everyone that's made the effort to go out and rate us in the iTunes store. We have more than a handful of ratings now, and I really appreciate it. I know that some of you don't necessarily use iTunes, and it was an effort for you to go out there and have to sign up for it, but I definitely appreciate your efforts. As you subscribe to the podcast and rate and review it, it helps the show gain more publicity, spreads our message out to more people, and I appreciate your efforts as you help us grow this audience. On a personal note, I also wanted to let you know that I'm back in my home state of Utah. Some unexpected business came up, and I had to leave for a couple weeks. But fortunately, because I live my life in a wealth-steading manner, I was able to make that happen without missing too much of a beat. In future episodes, we'll probably discuss preparedness and wealth-steading your life. But I'll just comment now to let you know that it's a real blessing to live your life in a manner where you can be prepared. If you set yourself up and build your lifestyle around a wealth-steading manner, you have the financial resources and the emergency fund to use when something comes up unexpected. You don't have to rely on credit cards. If you've built your business around your lifestyle, or even better yet, if you have a business that runs itself where you can be an absentee manager, then you can just pick up and go take care of other issues. I made sure when I constructed my business that it could fit in a briefcase, and as long as I had a high-speed internet connection, I could run my business from anywhere. And so, over the last few weeks, as some things came up that I hadn't expected, I was able to not only take care of those things, but I was also able to fully 100% run my business and my investment firm. And if you notice, I even was able to knock off a couple, two or three podcasts while I was out. That's wealth steading. And finally, as we talk about in wealth steading, the most important part is having social capital. Whenever something unexpected comes up or an emergency comes up, it's always important that you have that social capital built up so you can rely on your family and friends to help you out in times of need. Now, none of us are bulletproof. None of us can survive every storm. But you should really do your best to assess your personal situation, where you're at now, and what you would need to do to put the things into effect so that you could drop everything and go out and handle an emergency situation or just take advantage of a situation that came up that you weren't anticipating. That's how you continue to build your wealth. An opportunity may come along it's right for you to take advantage of, but if you're so cumbered down in the minutiae of day-to-day life, if you can't get away from your 9-to-5 grind at your cubicle, or if you don't have any money to invest in the opportunity, you won't be able to take advantage of it. Again, that's what wealth studying is all about. So do your best to prepare yourself so you can take advantage of opportunities and you can live through emergencies. So let's get right into the main topic of today's show, and that's answering listener questions and inquiries. We've had a wide variety of questions, and I try and lump those into common topics and subjects for us to discuss. Questions that I'll answer today are going to revolve around credit card usage and taking advantage of things like credit card offers, credit union offers, incentives, things like that. Our second topic will be about trading in non-stock asset classes, things like trading in foreign currency exchange, using options, and trading in commodities. So let's get started with our discussion on credit card usage. Now, these questions were prompted by our previous episodes about how to get started in saving, particularly saving when you just have a small sum of money. So we received a number of questions about my opinion on using credit cards and then what impact that may or may not have on your life or your saving status. Let me start out by saying that, you know, I'm not dogmatic like Dave Ramsey. If you're familiar with Dave Ramsey's work, he does a lot of good. He advises people to just tear up their credit cards and never use them. And that's probably appropriate for his audience. I think my caliber of listener is a little bit different and probably farther into savings than Dave's average listener is. I don't tell people not to use credit cards. I use them all the time. I've had a credit card probably since I was about 20 years old. But what I'll tell you about my credit card usage, in the 30-odd years that I've owned a credit card, I have never once carried a balance. If I can't pay for it in 30 days, I don't charge it. It's been a key component to my building wealth. I don't purchase things I can't afford. I avoid paying interest at all costs. I understand you may need to do that for a car or for a mortgage on your home, but where possible, when you have the discipline and the opportunity, I suggest that you don't even do that. Over the years, I've driven a lot of old crappy cars because I wanted to pay cash for them and I didn't want to go in debt to buy a new one. Again, I think that's a key foundation of why I'm financially independent today, because I made those sacrifices early. But I'm not opposed to using credit cards. They're convenient. They're easy. I use them all the time. And if you think you're responsible, I think you should too. You're an adult. Use things wisely. It's like drinking alcohol. Personally, I don't consume alcohol, but it's none of my business if you choose to. If you want to have a glass of wine at dinner or after dinner have a drink, a bourbon or a brandy, that's fine. And I realize not everybody can control their alcoholic consumption. Some people are alcoholics. They need to avoid it. If you're not mature enough or don't have the discipline to handle a credit card, then by all means, cut them up, tear them up, grind them. Stay away from them. But if you have the discipline, go ahead and use them appropriately. And that's a subject I want to focus on around some of the listener questions. People asked what my opinion was about using credit card incentives. If you're like me, you probably get offers all the time through email or in your mailbox. You know, how to get 100 or 200,000 points on an American Express card, or sign up for this Visa card and earn enough points to get a round-trip ticket to Europe. Hey, I'm not opposed to any of that. Again, I think you're an intelligent adult, and you should act accordingly. If you get a deal in the mail that's something like, hey, you have to spend $25,000 or $30,000 on a credit card, and it doesn't require you not to make minimum payments, and that $25,000 or $30,000 is something that you know you're going to spend anyways over the course of the next 3 or 6 months, you want to put on that credit card, pay it off at the end of every month, take advantage of getting a free ticket to Europe, hey, more power to you. For many years, I was in industrial sales, outside sales. I was traveling around the country and around the world. Sometimes I put those company expenses on my personal credit card, if the company didn't mind. And then at the end of the month, I did an expense report, they reimbursed me, and I paid off my personal credit card. I was able to rack up a lot of points. If you can do that for airlines, hotel stays, cash back, that's fine. Again, if you're responsible, if you can handle it, if you want to take the time to make sure you read the fine print, make sure there's no underlying things in that contract that's going to get you into trouble, make sure that you have the cash reserve and you'll be able to pay that off at the end of the month, and you also have the time to invest into it to make sure you're taking advantage of the opportunities and the offerings, then go for it. Yeah, I don't have any problem with that. I use a credit card for nearly all my purchases. It's easy, it's convenient, and I can rack up points for different things. If I go down to the store and they're willing to give me a 3 or 5 or 10% discount for using cash, hey, I'll be more than happy to do it. I have the cash. I can write them a check or go down to the ATM machine and pull it out and give it to them. But it's been my experience, as far as buying things retail, that most people don't offer a cash discount. And if they're not going to give me a discount, then there's no need for me to be carrying cash around in my pocket. Now, it's not the purpose of this podcast to get into the nitty-gritty about what's the best frequent flyer mile program to use or something like that. Everybody has different priorities. Everybody likes different things. We all can go out and use Google, so I'll let you do that on your own or listen to somebody else's show for that kind of advice. But I'd tell you, hey, take advantage of it. Treat it like free money. Something I like to do with one of my credit card companies is build up the points where they then let me buy gift cards from certain retailers. And if you're patient and you save up your points and you wait for the right opportunity, a lot of times it's around the holiday season, these different retailers will offer you incentives. So for example, you may get 15% off of a gift card. So you can use $85 worth of points to get a $100 gift card. I remember one year I was able to get something like a 15% discount on $1,500 worth of Amazon gift cards. Now imagine that, Amazon gift cards, I mean, that's like the best currency in the world. You can get everything you want through Amazon. There was no time limit, no restrictions on when you could use them. It's very convenient, and I had a lot of fun spending that money. So definitely take advantage of those incentives when you can find them. We also had some questions around credit cards and how that affected your credit score. For example, how much you may use your credit cards, or if you had a lot of cards that you didn't use, or if you canceled a card, you know, how all those things may affect your credit score. You know, again, something like that, I'm not an expert. I'm really the wrong guy to be asking that kind of stuff because I really don't care about my credit score. I know it's used for a lot of things. They use it for background checks. They use it if you're going to go apply for a new job or if you're going to borrow money, obviously it's used. I think it's used sometimes to calculate your insurance premiums, but I really don't let that dictate my life. I have my own company. I have no intentions of filling out a job application or going to work for anybody else. For the most part, I don't borrow money, but I know that I do have a good credit rating, and that's because I do use a lot of credit cards. I charge a lot on them. I pay my bills on time. Now, if you have too many credit cards or not enough credit cards or you're charging too much, that can all have a negative impact on your credit score. Believe it or not, canceling your credit cards can also have a negative impact on your credit score. But by far, the worst thing you can do to your credit score is to have bad credit, right? To not pay your bills on time, to have a bankruptcy, to sell a house on a short sale. These are all the major things that are going to affect you. If you have a credit card or you have 10 credit cards and you use them responsibly and you pay them on time, and then you decide to cancel one or get an extra one or something, it's going to have a minimal impact on your credit score. Pay your bills promptly, pay them on time, have a good payment history. That's what's going to give you a good credit rating. Now, as far as other financial incentives you may receive, some people mentioned using local credit unions or even local banks that offer a lot of incentives. Again, I think that's great. If you have the time and effort and the money to take advantage of those things, you should definitely do that. one person pointed out, when you're first saving that initial $1,000 or $5,000, you might be able to go to a local credit union and take advantage of some tickler savings rates they may have. Maybe they might be paying 3 or 4 or 5% in order to get your business. That's great. Definitely take advantage of that. I don't know everything that's going on in your local area. I don't know what credit unions you may or may not be able to join, or what local bank incentives may be happening in your area. But absolutely, look for the best deal. If you can get an introductory high interest rate by taking out a certificate of deposit or opening up a savings account, if it works out for you, that time period that you plan on saving the money, absolutely do it. If you can get 4% from a credit union, take it, because you're certainly not going to get that in a standard savings account anywhere right now. There are always all kinds of deals going on. Some discount brokers may be offering you, you know, an iPad or an iPhone if you open an account with $50,000 or something like that. Again, this is something like, if you were planning on opening an account at a discount broker and you have $50,000 that you were going to put into it, and you look at your options, you look at Charles Schwab and E-Trade and TD Ameritrade, these different brand name guys, and one of them is offering a better deal. You know, you can get an iPad if you open up your account and keep it there for 6 months. Well, you know, all things being equal, go ahead and do that. I mean, if you're going to do it anyways, and if you think that Company A's executions on their trades and everything else is just as good as Company B's, and Company B is going to offer you an iPad, well, hey, go for it. You know, just make sure you've read the fine print. And that takes us into our next topic, where some people asked me about my opinion about trading in things other than stocks. Obviously, if you've been listening to these episodes, you know that over the years I've made my money trading common stocks. I love trading common stocks, and that's where my emphasis and my expertise is. So what do I think about trading foreign currencies, the use of trading in commodities or using options? Well, let's break a couple of those things down. First of all, foreign currencies. My personal preference is, if I'm going to trade a foreign currency, I'm going to do it through an exchange-traded fund. As I've mentioned in past episodes, ETFs or exchange-traded funds, they trade just like stocks. They can be very liquid. They can be very cost-effective. They can trade at low transaction fees. You can run them through your discount broker. And so if I wanted to go speculate or invest on the yen or the euro, I would do that in an established exchange-traded fund. But generally, I don't do that. Generally, I focus on the U.S. dollar. And I focus on the U.S. dollar because I live in America. I know all about America. America is the number one market in the world. The U.S. currency is the reserve currency for the world. All other currencies, to one degree or another, are either affected by or measured by performance of the U.S. dollar. And so that's why I focus on what I know. I focus on the U.S. dollar. If I think the U.S. dollar is going to appreciate against other world currencies like the euro or the yen, then I would buy the exchange-traded fund UUP. That's the symbol for it. It's a U.S. dollar index UUP. That's Uniform Papa. Again, you can purchase that through your discount broker. It's a highly liquid fund. Millions of shares are traded in every day. It's easy to track. And currently, I have a position in the U.S. dollar through UUP with my own personal money as well as client money. I've been invested in the dollar for quite some time, and it's really only recently that it started to pick up. I'll talk about that in a minute, but let's jump back to the other side of that. So what if I don't think the dollar is such a good deal? What if I think the dollar is going to go down against other currencies like the euro, like the yen? Well, there's an exchange-traded fund for that as well, and the ticker symbol for that is UDN. That's Uniform Delta November. UDN. That's inverse to the dollar. So when the euro or the yen go up, the UDN would go up. If the U.S. dollar goes up, then the UUP would go up. So those two very simple, very easy to acquire exchange-traded funds can cover me whether I think the dollar is going up or whether I think the dollar is going down. And for the most part, I would say that's where I make 99% of my currency transactions. Now, can you make money trading the Australian dollar or the Canadian dollar or the New Zealand dollar or whatever, the Singapore dollar? Absolutely, you can. But you know what? I don't live in Singapore. I'm not an expert on the Singapore economy. I don't know all the intricate details about Singapore. And so for the most part, I don't invest there. I definitely don't invest in their currency. Now, I may from time to time invest in an exchange-traded fund that trades in the top stocks in the Singapore stock market, but that's a whole different animal than investing specifically in currencies. So for the most part, I'm limited to the UUP if I think the dollar is going up, and the UDN if I think the dollar is going down. Now, while we're talking about the dollar, I mentioned that I have some positions in that. I've been holding them for about a year, just some small positions, nothing huge. And I'll tell you, they really haven't moved. Over the last year, the dollar has either been flat or it's been down. But I've held on to my positions because I knew that there was light at the end of the tunnel. I knew the dollar wasn't going to zero. Although you can never be sure, I felt pretty confident that it wasn't going to drop 10 or 20%. So I was willing to wait and deal with the fluctuations as it moved up and down, you know, 1 or 2 or 3% over the last year. Now, recently, because of the recession and deflation in Europe, because things falling apart again in Japan, the U.S. dollar has been rising nicely. It had been hovering around its 50-day moving average, and that's a key indicator that we always talk about, the 50-day moving average. Well, the dollar had been hovering around that. It broke below it, but it didn't collapse. It just stayed right around a little bit above, a little bit below. And finally, about 6 weeks ago, it started on an uptrend, and it's up about 2.5% over the last 6 weeks. Now, again, this isn't a huge run-up. This isn't something you're going to make millions in, but that's the beauty of investing in the U.S. dollar, and that's the reason I do it. I know that I'm probably not going to make a lot of money, but I'm also probably not going to lose a lot of money, that there's some volatility there, but it's going to swing maybe 2, 3, 4, 5% over the course of a year or two. So by listening to this podcast, you know when I'm concerned about the stock market, I like to go to cash. I like to go into a money market fund. Well, right now, for the most part, money market funds are paying about zero in interest. So rather than just sitting specifically in cash in a money market fund, I can take some of that and put it either into the UUP if I think the dollar is going to go up, or I can put it into the UDN if I think the dollar is going to go down. And then that way, for the most part, I'm still really in cash because I'm invested in the U.S. dollar. I'm just invested in relative terms against other major currencies like the euro. And instead of sitting in a money market and getting, you know, near 0% interest rate, I can maybe pick up 1 or 2 or 3%. Now, again, this isn't going to make you rich, but this is the kind of money that can help you keep up with inflation, and it can help defer other transaction costs, so you can think of it as a little bit of allowance money. So just to review, the reason you would put your money into the UUP, the reason you would be bullish on the U.S. dollar, is you think that it's going to go up against other major world currencies. We saw about 6 weeks ago that while the dollar had been hovering around its 50-day line, once it bounced off the 50-day line, there was some resistance it had at about a 1% move. A couple weeks ago, it broke through that, and it's moving up. We also hear that the European Bank is getting ready to have their own quantitative easing program. So while the U.S. is supposedly going to start tightening up on their central bank money, the Europeans are going to start letting theirs flow more loose. That should help the dollar. That's probably why it's rising, and we're part of that trend. Something else is very positive about the U.S. dollar right now, and this is getting back more to the technical side, looking at the chart. Because it had either been moving down or had been flat for the last year, the 200-day moving average overall had been moving down. With this recent uptick in the dollar over the last 6 weeks, the 200-day moving average line is flattening out, and the 50-day line is coming up and has crossed through the 200-day. That's a very bullish sign. So as we look at it today, the dollar is sitting nicely above its 10-week moving average, the 200-day line is flat and looks like it's starting to reverse directions up, and the 50-day moving average is definitely on an upswing and has cut through, has intersected through that 200-day moving average. These are all very bullish signs. Now, as I'm talking about these 10-day moving averages, 50, 200-day moving averages, we've discussed these in previous podcasts. If you're not sure what that looks like or how to figure it out, go to any of the stock charting services online. They're all free. You know, whether you're using something simple like Yahoo Finance, just go there, put in whatever stock you're looking at. It'll bring up a chart for you. You can look at that chart in terms of, you know, year-to-date, the last 1 year, the last 5 years of performance. And there'll also be a place on there that you can check to look at technical indicators. So, for example, I'm looking at Yahoo Finance right now. Across the top of their charts, there's a little indicator there that says technical indicators. If you click on simple moving averages, that's in the drop-down menu, and then in there it lets you plug in three things, three events or three periods. You can put in 10, 50, and 200, and then that chart, and then let it draw the chart again, and that'll actually show you where the stock chart is in relationship to the 10-day, the 50-day, and the 200-day moving average. It's easy for you to do. It's a great indicator. I encourage you to do that on the stocks that you follow. So those are my thoughts on trading foreign currencies. The other part of that question was, how do I feel about trading commodities or using options? Well, as far as commodities go, I've never traded them. I don't trade them. It's a little bit like the foreign currencies. You know, that's a very specialized field. And again, like the foreign currencies, unless you're really living in that market, you can get burned very quickly. I don't know about wheat prices, pork bellies, coffee prices. I'm sure you can make a lot of money and do very well trading in those markets. That's just not where my expertise is. And up till this point in my life, I haven't had a need or desire to study them. Maybe at some point I will. But for right now, I'm engrossed in the stock market. That's where I live my life. That's what I study. That's what I love. So no, I don't trade commodities. But yes, I do use options. And I use options in two manners. One is sort of a simple speculation, and the other is for protection. So as to the speculation, from time to time, I may take a very small position, and speculate in the direction of a market or an industry using options. For example, petroleum or oil products. If I see some short-term trouble brewing in the Middle East and the price of oil shoots up, I may purchase a put on an oil contract because I believe that over the short term that price is going to come back down and I can make money by selling that put. Now, for some of you that may not be knowledgeable in options when I'm talking about puts and calls and things like that, it may not make sense. We'll come back in future episodes and try and explain some of that. But just to answer this question quickly about options, again, I may purchase a put because I think short-term oil prices are going to come back down. Purchasing that put would be a method of speculating. That may occur over a number of weeks or a number of months, but that's all. It's very short-term. But the main way that I use options and that I would recommend it to others is to use it to protect your position. For example, if you want to invest in the S&P 500 and you want to take a large position in it, you can not only purchase the exchange-traded fund for the S&P 500, which would be ticker symbol SPY, that's Sierra Papa Yankee, but you could also buy some protection with a put. You could buy a put on the SPY as well. And again, I'm not going to go into all the details in this particular episode, but trust me on this, you can use that sort of like short-term life insurance on your stock. You have to pay a premium, and you would want that premium to be as little as possible. And should your stock go up, that's not a problem because the capital gain that you're making on the stock will more than pay for the small premium that you had to pay for the protection. On the other hand, if the stock or the index stays flat or goes down, you're protected from losing no more money than the premium you paid. Now, I think that's a very good use for options. It's not speculative, it's for protection. Again, we'll talk about that more in the future. Well, one other thing I did want to mention, several people have asked me why I don't have a comment section on my blog or on my website. Well, let me see if I can cover this quickly. My firm is a licensed investment advisory firm. As such, I'm regulated either by the state or the Security and Exchange Commission, and they have very stringent rules on what can and can't be done. One of the rules, and personally I think this rule makes absolutely no sense, but one of the rules is that you can't have testimonial advertisements. So if you ever see an ad that someone's promoting and it says something like, this particular person has great recommendations on the stock market, or they made me so much money, blah, blah, blah. Well, if you see that, you know one of two things. You know that they're not a licensed or a registered investment advisor because that's illegal, so that they're probably not an investment advisor. Or number two, if they are an investment advisor, you know that they're breaking the law, so they're probably not a good investment advisor. In any case, so where that comes back to comments and things on my blog and on my website, the Securities and Exchange Commission has very stringent rules on what is and what isn't testimonial advertising, and they consider simple things such as comments on websites as being interpreted as being a testimonial, and they've really taken this stuff to the extreme. For example, if you go to my LinkedIn page, where it just has my personal profile, I have deactivated all the referrals and the likes and all that kind of stuff, so you can't go to like Facebook or my LinkedIn page or something and say that you like me, because I don't want to give any indication to the SEC that I'm supporting testimonial advertisements. I don't agree with all the rules and regulations that the SEC or the states put out, but I abide by them. And I don't ever want to give any regulator even an indication that I'm trying to skirt the law. So I go well above and beyond anything I need to do to avoid getting in trouble with the regulators. That's why I have the comments section and things like that turned off on my website, on my podcast, on my LinkedIn profile. So if you want to give me personal comments, again, you can email those to me through the websites. I'm happy to try and answer those on the air. Some of you I can respond to in email as well. I do get inundated with emails, so I'm not able to answer everybody individually. The other thing I would say is it's not testimonial advertisement if this occurs on a third-party website. So for example, that's why you're able to go to the iTunes site and you're able to rate this podcast. Now, there and again, you're not really saying anything about me being an investment advisor. You're just rating the specific podcast. But I can't have you do that on my own website because I control that. That could be an appearance that I'm promoting testimonial advertisement. If you go to the Apple site or you go to the iTunes store and you put a comment in there, that's a third party. I don't control that. I can't regulate it. I can't go in and delete comments that I don't like. I can't do any of those kind of things on a third-party website. I have no control over what Apple publishes. And so therefore, that's why you can do that at Apple, or you can go on to, you know, a site like Yelp or something like that and rate me there. You just can't do it on a website that I personally or my firm personally controls. So I hope that makes sense to you. But that is why in the future you won't see any forums or comment sections on my websites. I just want to stay well within the regulations of the Security and Exchange Commission. And I guess I'll close by reminding you not to rely on the regulators or the SEC to protect you. You need to be able to protect your own investments. Remember Bernie Madoff? He ran a Ponzi scheme for 25-some years, and in those 25 years, he had many audits. He never failed one of them. So don't trust any government agency to protect your money. You have to do the best you can to protect it yourself. Well, that'll wrap up today's episode. Again, I thank all of you that made the effort to go out and rate the show at the iTunes Store. I know many of you are sharing this podcast. You're telling your friends and family about it. I appreciate that. I even know a few of you are making your teenage kids listen to it. So good for you. That's great parenting. Until next time, this is John Pugliano. As always, I'm wishing you the very best of returns. Thanks for listening.